Hi, listeners. I'm Brian, and this is The World as We See It, the podcast that follows me on my travels to gain some perspective from the interesting people I meet on the way.
Okay, Andy Aronson here. Today we're talking with Karthik. Karthik, first of all, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yeah, you are. You got it.
Okay. And tell us, how did you meet Brian?
Brian contacted me on the website couchsurfing.org. I have a profile there that he seemed to like for some reason, so he contacted me. I live in Flint, Michigan, and maybe there's just not that many other interesting profiles, but mine seemed to stick out for some reason.
Okay. How many times do you get people, like how often do people contact you from couchsurfing?
It mostly depends on what city I live in. I lived in Detroit for a year, and I got quite a few requests there. I live in Grand Rapids for 2 years, and I think I got maybe like one request over the 2 years, and I've lived in Flint now for 1 month, and I've gotten two requests. So,
does that surprise you that people are coming through Flint?
It seems like people want to go to the places where people get killed the most often for some reason. So, that seems to be the pattern.
Have you considered moving to a more dangerous place so you could have more couch surfers?
I think I'd have to leave the country then.
So, how long have you been doing this? How many couch surfers have you had?
So we're talking about formally, like through the website, right?
Well, you can talk about whatever you want, really.
Well, I'll just say that I've had people, cause I think it started in college probably when I started living with, you know, a bunch of other people. So when I started living in houses more than five people, we just got a lot of, we'd pick up hitchhikers that would stay at the house, and then some other people would have couch surfing things that they would come and stay with us for like up to like 2-3 months sometimes. And so that probably started when I was like 18. And then I got my own profile, when I was like maybe like 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been going on since then. But you know, more or less this culture of people going and like crashing at people's couches I've done since I was a teenager.
And I have no idea how old you are. You don't have to say exactly if you don't want to, but.
Oh, I'm not embarrassed. I'm 25.
Okay, so 7 years or something like that.
Yep, yeah.
So, picking up hitchhikers
mm-hmm.
and bringing them to your house.
Mm-hmm.
What, do you pick up hitchhikers a lot?
I don't anymore. And that's something that, being in a college town is really easy. Like, all you'd really have to do is walk outside your house or go down to, like, the railroad tracks and you'd always meet people. But it was never that hard there. Living in a place like Flint or Detroit or even Grand Rapids is a little bit harder. I lived in East Lansing for a while too, and that's where MSU is. So, there, and I went to U of M for 3 years. So in Ann Arbor, both of those places, it's really easy to get hitchhikers.
Well, now, did you go out searching for hitchhikers? Was it like today I'd like to have a hitchhiker take a ride with me?
No, it's just people that you meet. And a lot of times they're not even technically hitchhikers. They're just people that hitchhiked in and then, just asking for money, and they happen to be young and they happen to get along with you, so you invite them in.
And did you give them money?
No. Well, I mean, it might start as that way, but then we get into a conversation, and then before you know it, you're having drinks with them. So,
you know, my concern is, hey, I walked downtown, I'm hanging out, here's this cool dude, he hitchhiked into town or whatever, we get to chat and he's a cool guy. Hey, you want to hang out some more? Hey, do you need a place to share? Say, yeah. Well, you can crash on our couch, okay? And then, like, the next day, he's like, can you buy me a burrito?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, did you end up in those things where, like, the guy was basically mooching off you for 3 months?
That kind of situation's only happened through couch surfing, actually, not even picking up hitchhikers. I think we had a few people in Ann Arbor that were like that, and at some point, you just got to kick them out.
So tell us about your experiences being a couchsurfing host.
Being a couchsurfing host. Well, are you thinking of like specific experiences?
Well, I don't know.
Why
not?
At all.
Like what kind of people you would get?
Yeah. They're usually young, you know, and I think that's probably a part of the reason why I let them come into my house is that we got a lot of like common areas that we can talk about. Probably has to do with their age.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I remember, man, the best like couch surfers I had, I picked up in Ann Arbor. And there was three of them and a dog, and they were interesting themselves, but the coolest thing was that their dog was like the same dog that was in Mad Max 2. Have you ever seen that movie?
I don't remember seeing it.
Oh, it's a really cute cattle dog. It looked exactly the same. So I invited them over and we ended up hanging out for like 2 weeks after that, just like camping around Ann Arbor and having a good time. But I don't know, there have been situations like that. There was one when I was in Detroit, I was living on a farm inside Detroit, and there was this woman that came and was couch surfing with us, and she didn't leave for like, I think she stayed there for longer than I was there, so I think she stayed there for like a solid year, if not more. but she ended up working on the farm and contributing, so it wasn't a problem at all.
Okay.
Yeah, it was great. We wanted her there, so.
It pays to be likable, right?
Yeah.
So when I've never used couchsurfing.org, when people use it, can you say, no, I'm sorry, I don't want you to come to my house? You don't seem credible enough?
I'd hope so, right? Otherwise anybody could come in. Yeah, you can do that. You can do that. I've yet to do that, but I think most of the time people just don't respond if you think somebody's too shady.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. I was hesitant with Brian, but I let him in. Let him. something about him.
To be fair, I'm a very sketchy looking individual.
I think we need to have somebody illustrate your sketchbook.
Oh, are you asking? Well, he's got a fairly scruffy beard. It's I don't know. And his back seat, it looks like, kind of looks like he lives there, but I think he does, which is fine. But,
yeah, there's a reason it looks like that.
But you know.
Literally have somebody draw a caricature of sketchy looking Brian, but I appreciate your painting a verbal picture for us as well.
Okay.
So tell us about urban farming.
Urban farming.
Cause you lived on a farm in Detroit.
I did. And, it's interesting. I mean, you know, it's hard for me to talk about it on more of a global sense, but as far as Detroit goes, it's a movement there that I can't tell you what the roots of it are necessarily, because it probably dates back to, you know, like the Great Exodus, where, a lot of African American people moved north from the South back, you know, during like segregation and all that. But currently it's a whole part of this progressive movement in Detroit and probably most Midwestern cities like Flint and Toledo and Lansing. That works to reclaim vacant land because so many people and so many industries have left the area over the last century.
Yeah, this is what I've read about Detroit, that there's enough people who have left that they're just whole neighborhoods that are empty.
That's right. If you take all the vacant land in Detroit and put it together, and it's still bigger than the city of San Francisco. So if that gives you any idea.
Yeah. The city of San Francisco, of course, is not. It is famously smaller than you think.
That's fair.
It's only seven square miles. But it's still pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So what do you think, Detroit? How long did you live there?
I lived there. So I started medical school 2 years ago. So I did an AmeriCorps there the year before that. And, you know, I've had my experiences there before that, too. But I lived there solidly for a year living on this farm. What is that, 2010 or 2009? Something like that.
I reserve the right not to do arithmetic after.
Well, it's one of those.
Okay.
Yeah.
I believe you.
A couple of years ago, how about that?
Okay, and what do you think of Detroit?
I think it's, you know, I've done a decent bit of traveling, and I'm Indian, you know, I was born in India, and I've gone back quite a few times, and I got family all around the world, and still to this day, I don't think I've seen a place that's more interesting than them, Detroit, Michigan. I can't wrap my head around that city at all.
Why is it interesting? I'm not saying it's not, but what do you
think? I think that there's the statistics on it. That's the stuff that everybody knows, which is it's murder capital in the U.S. It's been slowly vacated since like the 1960s. So those things people know. But then beyond that, it's got such the economy of Detroit and the culture of Detroit is really like, to like the very root of it is grassroots. You know, it's, I think it like epitomizes what like grassroots means in a sense, just because there hasn't been too much else to rely on except for your neighbors and whoever else just chose to stay in the city.
It's people making something out of nothing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Interesting. And do you think that that's a Detroit phenomenon? You talked about there being other cities in the Midwest that have had flight and had to deal with similar things.
Right. I think that it probably exists in every city, but it's just so easy to find in that city. It's just, it kind of defines the city of Detroit, is that sense of like helping out your neighbor and mutual struggle, and how that puts people in similar places and gives people similar stories to talk about. And then kind of like the social movements that come out of that sense of unity and what people have been through.
What kind of examples have you seen of all this while you were there?
I lived in an interesting neighborhood. It was called North Corktown, and for older residents, it was called the Briggs neighborhood. And that neighborhood, there was so much vacant land, and there were so many burnt out houses. Which all happened, you know, in like the 1980s, a lot of houses got burnt down there. I think they say, 1988, Devil's Night, 72 hours, there were like 800 fires that you could see from like the top of your roof. And that neighborhood is one of those neighborhoods that was pretty heavily hit. So there's just, you know, there'll be one house, it's this beautiful, majestic, like Victorian era house, and then you won't see anything for like 10 acres, and there'll be another house right next to it. So, in that kind of environment, you had all the neighbors talking to each other, everybody knew each other, everybody knew what was going on, and everybody was doing different projects too. So, one woman had kind of developed, like, she was a, what would you call it? She welded things, basically, so she would weld things for the neighborhood, and she was starting up a, like, taco shop in a old trailer. And everybody's helping out with that. And then the house that I lived on had like a 1-acre farm that everybody helped out on. There was an abandoned apartment complex that the neighborhood had come together and made a non-profit, and they had repossessed it from the slumlord that was owning it, because half of it was burnt out and he was still collecting rent. So they were starting to develop it into a community center, basically, and mixed income housing for the neighborhood. So that's probably just like a fraction of like all the things that were going on in that neighborhood, of how people are helping each other out. And those are the bigger things too, because the smaller things are like, you know, if somebody needed some work on their house because a storm came in or something, everybody would come and help out.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that was really interesting. And not to mention, with all that vacant land, there were all these pheasants running around everywhere, and like, there were like packs of dogs. I saw a pack of like 12 dogs run through that area. And it was right next to the abandoned train station, which, if people know Detroit, that's like right next to downtown. It's just a short walk to downtown. So it's just a really surreal, environment to be in.
It's almost post-apocalyptic.
It's at least post-industrial. But yeah,
Does a pack of dogs scare you?
The pack of dogs, you know, what's funny, like, the dogs in Flint, they'll chase you. The dogs in Detroit, they never really bother. They stayed away from people. I don't know why.
Mm.
Yeah. It's funny that you say post-apocalyptic. A couple of years ago, they tried to make a movie about, post-Katrina New Orleans in Detroit. And because Detroit looked like post-Katrina New Orleans more than New Orleans did. And the film crew got robbed and somebody got shot, like, during the shooting. God. Yeah, so it's just kind of like characterizes that whole city.
Did you feel unsafe? Did you feel like you might get attacked?
in areas, but again, I stuck to that neighborhood. I love that neighborhood, and I never felt like I was in trouble in that neighborhood. And that's kind of what I liked about that whole city, is that everybody had their neighborhood. Not to say that people didn't. A lot of people felt like they were in trouble. Like, you know, they didn't feel safe in their neighborhood. But, you know, you were able to find neighborhoods where people are helping each other out more so than anywhere else I've ever been.
How did you end up there?
I was doing AmeriCorps.
Oh, right. You said that.
Yep. I was teaching nutrition to sixth graders.
And do sixth graders enjoy learning about nutrition?
No, they do not. And the teachers don't care. I sort of stopped caring at some point.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah, you know, it happens.
Why do the teachers not care?
Well, I shouldn't talk about all of them. A lot of them did care. But I think overall, they, you know, honestly, I can't even tell you why they didn't care. I don't know why they were teachers, you know, like maybe some of them were just there for an income, or maybe other teachers were there for some other reason and they didn't think nutrition was important. From what I could tell, they were all great teachers, but for that specific program, they just weren't that interested. So it's hard to tell.
Did you enjoy being in AmeriCorps?
Yeah, I did. But I think that it had more to do with the fact that I really learned to love that city. So I used AmeriCorps to get me connections in that city and meet people that I wouldn't normally meet. So it was interesting.
Was it your choice to go to Detroit?
No, I really wanted to go to Seattle, but I didn't think I could live on an AmeriCorps salary. So I went to Detroit.
Okay. And how did you end up in AmeriCorps?
I graduated from University of Michigan. My degree didn't really mean anything, and I didn't know what else to do, so I signed up for AmeriCorps. And I didn't know about med school yet, so I thought I'd kill the time with something else.
What do you mean you didn't know med school yet? Surely you knew that there were med schools.
Yeah, I did know that there were med schools. I didn't know that I wanted to go to med school yet. I knew
that out. When did you figure that out?
I mean, the process started while I was still at the University of Michigan, but, I had to think about it for that year. So it was sometime during that year that I kind of decided that it was probably the best decision for me.
I'm Andy Aronson. We'll be right back on The World As We See It.
I want one more chance, an allowance advance. I want absolution too. So they'll stay and they'll wait.
Welcome back. I'm Andy Aronson, and today we're talking with Karthik. And you're in med school now, right?
I am in med school now, yeah.
So I don't know anything about med schools in Michigan. Where is your school?
Michigan State University is, Michigan State University is based in East Lansing, but they have satellite campuses everywhere. And the way the med school works is the first 2 years, you're basically just reading books and taking tests, just like undergrad. But then the second 2 years, you're working in hospitals. So my second 2 years, I came to Flint to work at the two hospitals that are in the city here.
Okay, so you're in your third year?
Yep, that's right. I just started.
Okay. Is med school year-round?
The third and fourth years are, yeah.
Okay, so you're just getting into that.
Yep.
You're just getting into the really hard stuff, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I just started on the psych rotation, which is notoriously, like, easier as far as workload goes, but it's still pretty easy. I mean, sorry, I'm in the psychiatry rotation. It's interesting.
Interesting can mean a lot of different things.
It can mean a lot of different things. It's true.
Do you feel like sharing with us what you mean by interesting?
So human beings are, you know, like they're my brethren, you know, like I identify as a human being along with all my psych patients, and we're in this world together. Some people are crazy.
Yes.
And the realization of just how crazy people can be is kind of is kind of shocking sometimes.
Aha. Uh-huh. Yes. I have a friend who is seriously planning on going into social work.
Okay.
And I was talking to her about this, and she is not put off at all by the fact that she's going to be dealing with people with a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I say more power to her, because I think I would really, really struggle if my job was to day in and day out interact with people who had a lot of mental issues. I think that would be hard.
Absolutely.
So I think you're not at this point thinking that you will become a psychiatrist.
No, I don't think so. I want to go into family medicine, but a lot of the stuff that I learned in psychology is applicable and really interesting. So, I mean, I guess when I was saying that it's interesting and that, you know, some people are crazy, that doesn't mean that I feel like an aversion to it. It's just shocking. That's
uh-huh.
all. Yeah.
Like, perhaps you hadn't realized sort of the depths that, or differences that people can get to.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm pretty shocked by the fact that the human mind can play so many tricks on you. Or the, you know.
Would you see that movie Memento?
I did, a long time ago, though.
Oh. That one I found particularly alarming to me.
Yeah.
It struck a nerve. There's just too often that I don't think that I wish I would remember. I don't know, I thought that when you said, when you talked about the mind playing tricks on you.
Oh, absolutely. I saw a patient today, let's say, and she would be like all out laughing, you know, just rolling with laughter 1 second, and then all of a sudden, 2 seconds later, she'd be bawling and just crying. And it had to do with the fact that she got into a car accident and pretty much smashed the front of her head at some point. Mm-hmm. And had some permanent damage because of it. And she'd been suffering this since 2006.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just kind of, you know, it's just, I kind of think of like, if I break my leg or if I become debilitated for some reason, I feel like emotionally, like I'll be able to deal with it. Like I'll be able to go through with it. But it's kind of interesting to think of like, what if your coping mechanism itself, what if your brain, is the one to suffer? Like the very thing that you would use to adapt to injury is what is injured. And that is really what's shocking about being in psychiatry. And that goes for anyone who has, you know, major depression to, you know, schizophrenia to traumatic brain injuries. I'm just surprised by how many things can go wrong with your brain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, part of what's going on is that there's a lot of people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sort of get, just statistically, there's a likelihood that sort of everything that could go wrong will go wrong with someone.
Right.
And if you go to a hospital that treats those people, you're going to see all of them.
Exactly. That's true. You know, I have my friends who are doing surgery right now, and they see every gunshot wound in Flint. And granted, Flint's got a lot of gunshot wounds on a day-by-day basis, but they see every single one of them. So they're, you know, they don't necessarily want to go outside at night at all.
That kind of thing is going to color your impression of things. And I think it's going to color your impression of things, even if you think you're aware that it might color your impression of things.
Yep. Agreed. Yeah. Agreed. You can't really prepare yourself for that as much as you may think you can.
Well, I also think that you can't really trust your brain.
Right. Absolutely.
So you've studied the brain more than I have, but I've read a lot of snippets of stuff on the internet.
I'm sure that's just as just as valid, honestly.
I have a friend who studies the brain. He's at what's his name? Yale College of Medicine now? I can't remember. Anyway, and that's one of the things I got out of just over the years of talking to him about things. There's just a tremendous number of things that you think you're in, and your brain will just do wrong, just naturally.
Yeah, we still have animal instincts, don't we?
Yeah, basically. all right. So what should we talk about next?
Well, that's kind of up to you. You're the interviewer.
I know. And I could ask you stuff, and I will. But I have the sense that you have a varied background. So I'll open up and say, is there some interesting thing that we should ask you about?
Ah, that one's tough.
I know. I know, that's a big one.
How about this? You give me a topic, I'll tell you, a subtopic or whatever, and then we'll go through it.
All right. Food.
Food, okay. Wow.
What's your favorite food?
My favorite, yogurt. Okay, I got stuff I can talk about. I like yogurt. I like yogurt a lot.
Tell us about your love of yogurt. Is this some undying, oh my gosh, I can't believe how amazing yogurt is sort of thing?
I guess I have a family history with yogurt. And I really like the fact that it's a living organism that you're propagating when you make it. I don't know, have you ever made yogurt?
I've never made yogurt, no.
It's not too bad. You take some milk, you heat it up, you kill everything in it, and then you put in the culture, and you let it grow for 8 hours. And 8 hours forward, you got some yogurt. But what's interesting about it is that it was the way that people before refrigeration, and still people today who don't have refrigeration, keep their dairy products. So in my family, we've had yogurt for a long time, especially before refrigeration, which was only in the 1980s in my family. I kind of recently started exploring our yogurt culture and found out that it's a very unique taste, and it comes from my family for who knows how many hundreds of years ago, because every single day my grandma, will take a scoop of yogurt and put it into some raw milk and make yogurt for the next day, and she's been doing that her whole life, and she got her culture from her parents, who got it from their parents, and I just like the idea that yogurt kind of follows you with your
family. And are you doing that now as well?
I do. And that flavor of yogurt, there's this yogurt, like I was talking about, that my grandparents eat. It's got this very peculiar taste to it. And thinking about it, the culture goes back, who knows how many years, decades at least, if not more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And, so we've never gotten that taste here. When you buy yogurt at the store, it's really, they use maybe a handful of cultures over and over again, and you really can't duplicate, specific tastes. And you can go online and even find forums where people trade, different yogurt cultures, which I haven't done, but, there's very, specific tastes of different, yogurt cultures. But anyway, so we have this, this flavor that we've just never been able to find in the United States until, I took a trip to West Virginia last year. Actually, it was less than last year, so it was not too long ago. And we couch surfed actually with this, old couple that, they're interesting on their own. No, they were in their 60s or something like that. 60s.
I'm just kidding. All right, go ahead.
Gotcha. I didn't want to say anything. Yeah, 40s. They were an older couple that had been making kefir for a while, and kefir is a whole different kind of fermented dairy drink that's relatively unrelated to yogurt, although it uses lactobacilli that are similar. Anyways, not to get too technical about it, but basically it's a whole different drink. But their kefir drink that they had had for a long time tasted exactly like my grandma's drink, so I brought it back, and my parents agreed that for some reason this old couple in West Virginia, and they were in a really rural part of West Virginia, had a kefir culture that tasted exactly like this remote yogurt culture in southern India.
That is very surprising,
isn't it? I thought so. That's it, though. That's my story. But yeah.
So, did your grandmother's yogurt, you said you can't find this flavor in America. Did she not give some to your parents to bring over here? I mean,
we've never brought it back. And it's funny that you ask. I don't know why we never brought it back. Maybe
it's probably against the rules.
Right. It really might be all it was. I'm not sure why though. I should try to smuggle it back next time. Thanks for giving me that idea.
when the border guards lock you up, please don't finger me as a person.
Well, it's a little late for that, isn't it?
Crap. There's audio evidence.
There's audio evidence, though.
I'm just glad I won't be releasing this that mentions all of the smuggling until after I'm back in the United States.
That's probably a good idea.
That's right.
So, let me ask this. You said something about not having refrigeration until you were in the 80s.
Well, that's not me, that's my family, back in India.
Aha, uh-huh, okay.
Stuff like that was kind of late there, so.
Sure. But where I was going to go with that is, does that mean that you moved here in the 80s? But
I moved here in 1991.
Yeah. From?
From Palakkad, India, which is, it's in southern India. And okay. I moved straight to Michigan.
Okay, so you had refrigeration before the 80s, but you had some people who didn't.
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
That's right. Well, and by the time I was born, I think they had refrigeration.
When was that, like 1995? Wait.
Nice try. It was 87.
Okay. 87. Sorry, you didn't have to say the exact year.
Do you want me to give you my social security number too?
You know what? I think that would be a really bad idea. Do not give me your social security.
All right.
So, do you have many memories of India before you moved here?
Before? A lot of the places that I have visited since then are the same places that I grew up in. So, I mean, whatever memories I do have are probably just colored by whatever I saw after that. So, who knows? And I can imagine memories.
Sure.
So,
what was it like for you when you moved here? Do you remember?
Not much of it. I was 4 years old, so it was kind of hard to remember anything too concrete. I know it was really hard for the rest of my family.
Do you have older brothers and sisters?
I got an older sister. Yeah. She's 6 years older than me.
Okay. So she would have definitely had some serious transition to do.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
How have she and your parents adjusted? I mean, they've had a long time, I realize, but.
It took them a while, I think. It's hard to say. I mean, there are some things that I can say with confidence, like winters were not easy for my mother and mm-hmm. You know, like the whole middle school, like popularity game really killed my sister. Not literally, she's still alive. But you know, and my dad, he never had a job in one place. He was always moving around a lot for his job. So that doesn't necessarily have to do with being in the U.S., but I think all of that was just kind of hard for my family altogether.
Yeah. Well, those kind of hardships can bring people together or they can force them apart.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
What do you think it did for your family?
It's hard to tell, you know. I don't know what we would have been like otherwise. We're doing fine, though, so that's something.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
All right, so do you see yourself as being a Michigan person till the end of your days?
A Michigan person? I don't know. I really love that city. We were talking about Detroit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a good chance that I'll move back there, but I need some time away for a while after med school, I think.
Where do you think you'll go?
I think I'm going to try to go out to the West Coast. Maybe probably Washington.
Following your Seattle dreams again.
Following my Seattle dreams. Really anywhere with mountains, though, but Seattle is a nice city, so we'll see.
You know, I don't know much about Michigan. What kind of hills or mountains does it have? Does it have any?
It doesn't really have any. Well, the UP might be a little different, but that's like 12 hours away, so I might as well go to the Smokies from here.
Is that why you were in West Virginia?
That is why I was in West Virginia. And the fact that West Virginia is just a crazy place on the map, I think.
You know, from hearing you talk about what you like about Detroit,
mm-hmm.
and that West Virginia is a crazy place, you seem to have an interesting sense of what attracts you to a place. And I'm curious, what is it about West Virginia?
Yeah, I think that West Virginia was interesting to me because they have such a, you know, back in like the, what is it, I don't want to botch this too much, but back in the 60s or 70s, there was a government program there that was, I forget the specific name of it, it was like War Against Poverty, I think it was called. I think Johnson was heading it. And there were a lot of, basically AmeriCorps people that ended up in West Virginia and ended up, as being like anti-coal mining activists mm-hmm. that just stayed there. and developed communities there. And there's such a strong union history there too. You know, a lot of, you know, the 8-hour workday and the weekend are basically fights that were won in coal mining country, a lot of them in West Virginia. And I think that sense of unity is something that you can still feel there. And I love that. And I love the fact that for some reason or another, you go through West Virginia, there's no Walmarts or Home Depots or anything like that you pass by. There are still a lot of local businesses that people frequent, and it's just a really rich history that I love.
Do you think part of that is due to the geography, that people kind of end up in sort of one canyon or the next canyon, that kind of thing?
Absolutely.
So there's smaller communities?
I do. I mean, a big part of it is a lot of the community left. Basically, when mining changed, like the nature of mining changed from being underground mines that people went into to mountaintop removal, basically, where they just basically blow up the mountain. And mechanization of mining also, both of those things led to a lot of people going unemployed and moving out of West Virginia. So you kind of have those like small communities there that maybe didn't used to exist, which kind of adds to the wonder of it for me when I go in there, and the history that like I kind of want to explore. But I think another side to it also is, like you're saying, it's just, you know, different sides of the mountain are like worlds away from each other for a lot of people. So they kind of develop their own culture around them.
So what kind of a trip did you take to West Virginia? You mentioned couchsurfing. Were you there for a long time?
No, I think what we did was, that was around the time, that was 2011. Tornadoes had kind of ravaged the Midwest and kind of like the whole, Appalachian Trail there. So we went to Henryville, Indiana, which is just like the beginning of Appalachia on the western side. And the whole downtown had been decimated by a tornado. So we got there, the tornado happened at like maybe like 8 or 9 p.m. We got there at like 6 a.m. and worked at the rebuilding effort for a day. Then we drove over to West Virginia. We went to that couple's house and we stayed there for a few days, and then we explored all the community clinics around there, a lot of which were started by those activists that I'm talking about that ended up there because of the war on poverty a few decades ago. And then we just drove back, did some more relief stuff, and then drove back to Michigan. And I had to start school again. So I think all in all, that was like maybe 15 days.
And did you just say, there's a tornado, let's go do something, and you know, hopped in the truck, or?
Yeah, because we were going to go to West Virginia anyways, but then we heard in the news that this there was a bunch of tornadoes going through, and this town called Henryville just got decimated, so we thought, that's sort of on the way, why not just go by? So we did that. We kind of snuck in through back roads, because people weren't really allowed in at the time, and we got to take some interesting photos, meet a lot of people, and we learned a lot, and we got to offer a hand too, so ended up being a pretty rewarding trip, which I thank the people of Henryville for. I mean, that,
Yeah, so they welcomed you. They were happy to have people come in who were willing to be helpful.
Yeah, I think it worked out. I don't want to come off as seeming like I'm like a tourist of like, disaster
areas.
I'm not.
I don't think you are.
But
no, what I heard is you had a trip planned and you knew that this was happening already, and so you went to see if you could lend a hand.
Right. Well, and I also want to say, you know, being in medicine, I don't think that you'll find anybody who's in kind of like social work or any sort of service work that isn't also looking for some sort of personal sense of fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, even like just learning something through the work that they do. And but yeah. Anyways.
Which I think is quite natural, I think. Most of us are looking for that in one way or another.
Right. I think that's what drives us, in my personal opinion. I hope it's what drives us.
When you say us, do you mean all of humanity?
Yeah.
You and your buddies?
I do. I mean humanity.
That's it for this week, listeners. Comments? Questions? Let us know at nbetter.org. Or you can send me an email, brian@nbetter.org. I'd like to thank couchsurfing.org, without which this episode would not have been possible. I'd also like to thank our guest Karthik, and also Mary and Paul for the use of our theme song, Perilous Road. You can find it on our album, Something Fierce, along with the rest of her amazing work at maryandpaul.com. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening.
But if your wheels get to weaving, if you drive like you're drunk, you